Just make sure we're being recorded.
Hi, my name's John Hobson. What we wanted to do today was talk to you about an attempt to trial the Master Apprentice method in Australia. And just to give you a bit of background of our context, we come from southeastern Australia, and that's the environment, the linguistic environment that we're talking about, specifically if we're from the state of New South Wales. In our area, there are no first language speakers in terms of those people who speak their own language currently as a first language, although there are some elder people who did learn their language originally as their first language, but everyone would now use it as an L2. As far as we're aware, there is no natural transmission of the Australian languages happening in New South Wales, and consequently are associated with that limited language use in communities. There is some use, but it's not very high. Everyone is really an English speaker. We have a few formal language centres and authorities in operation. There's probably about three of significance within the state who are doing a lot of work in revitalisation. But there are a lot of languages that are not, and regions that are not serviced by any sort of a body at all. What we do have, paradoxically, is a rapid development of school-based programs. The K-10 Aboriginal Languages Syllabus New South Wales was published in 2003 and commenced implementation in 2005, and it's a generic syllabus for all Aboriginal languages potentially of the state, and it could work in any other state of Australia. It could be transported anywhere, I think, to any location, because it is generic. And that has facilitated a very rapid growth in the delivery of teaching programs in Aboriginal languages. And as I say, it's both stimulating but also to some extent diverting community effort away from community-based revitalisation and into schools-based revitalisation. So it's kind of an odd situation that we're in. Lots of community-based initiatives are developing as a result of that, and we do have rapid development of post-secondary courses. The dilemma we have in this context, though, is we don't have the speaking teachers in order to be doing the delivery. So there's a bit of a crisis in that regard. I have to look up here. Unfortunately, we don't have a monitor. So. Our interest in, the interest in Master Apprentice in Australia, there's been a very strong imperative to try and catch up with what's happening overseas. And there is a great sense of urgency, and maybe a bit of a quest for a magic silver bullet, some kind of quick fix that will get us out of the predicament that we find ourselves in. So we frequently see ideas like immersion, language nest, accelerated second language acquisition, and Master Apprentice are thrown up as quick. If we do what the New Zealanders are doing, we'll be all right. Or if we grab this idea from Canada or from America, that will fix our problem. That's the context in which Master Apprentice has been identified. And in particular, there's been a call for it to be incorporated in the school programs, and I'm not sure personally exactly how that would work. The National Indigenous Languages Survey in 2005 identified it as a potential strategy that should be used. And in the Indigenous Language Conference in Adelaide 2007, there's a recommendation there, which I think maybe Rob authored, and in the recently published current provision of Indigenous language programs in schools, which looked at the provision of teacher training, provision of language programs, Aboriginal language programs in Australian schools, and it was specifically chartered to evaluate the wider application of Master Apprentice and referred to a specific trial by the New South Wales Aboriginal Languages Research and Resource Centre. So, looking at the information that was reported in that was given in that report and other anecdotes around the country, what we've found is that what's being called Master Apprentice is variously any occurrence of adult-to-adult transmission in any context gets called Master Apprentice. Any one-to-one transmission gets called Master Apprentice. Any immersion activity or immersion style activity is called Master Apprentice. Immersion lessons are called Master Apprentice. One-to-one immersion of a native speaker by an external linguist is Master Apprentice, as is an older speaker of a language working in tandem with a trained teacher teaching the language in class. That's master-apprentice too. There's certainly some apprenticeship there, but it's a pedagogic apprentice rather than language learning. And the trial that was to be evaluated in that report I referred to on the previous slide has not actually occurred. So as far as we are aware, or had been aware until fairly recently, there had been no real genuine implementation of master-apprentice in Australia. But Takahashi, in 2007, I think maybe under your program, Margaret, had a go. And I mean, I think all praise to Takahashi for her efforts, and I'd say it was a very earnest attempt to actually implement master-apprentice. But I would have would suggest there were a few problems with the implementation. One would be that language centre staff from the location of Yinawanka, which is shown on the map there, were contracted as subjects. They had no prior training, but both had very strong experience in elicitation with linguists, and that in the findings was found to some extent pollute the process. Implementation and training was attempted live. So no prior training, but training the master and apprentice at the time of implementation. The sessions were linguist scripted, and they had very strong and clear elicitation goals to elicit paradigms. Today we're going to do the verbs, and we're going to do past, present, and future. The linguist was present in all sessions and recorded all sessions, and noted that, was conscious later that that interfered. There were some cross-cultural and I think remote area fieldwork issues for Takahashi, but it's being the first time that she had engaged in that kind of work. But they did make some very good progress and gave detailed explanation of it. In about 10 hours, I think, they managed to achieve. So in that context, what are we trying to do? What have we been trying to do? We're looking at Wala Bunjalung, which is located, as you can see on the map, in the northern rivers of New South Wales and over the border into southeast Queensland. That language does have, Bunjalung does have some school programs operating in other dialects. There's not one in Wallabal.
There is one in Benalbo.
But there's lots of issues about which dialect is which and what's appropriate, who's got authority and authenticity to teach. Lots of discussion, not always amiable, about these dialect issues and who has authority and authenticity. Fair bit of internecine disputes, a bit of family feuding. There's also limited documentation of the language, and although there is a practical authority, it's not necessarily agreed in the field. I think a number of different orthographies are being played with. Our participants have been the master speaker, Poppy Harry Walker, who is an elder in the community called Jubulum. Brad, who's sitting here, who's a student in the Master of Indigenous Languages Education degree at the University of Sydney, and Brad's also a teacher of Spanish and Japanese. It's very handy in this context. That's me, I run the course and pretend to be a linguist. The Many Rivers Aboriginal Language Centre, which is probably about the most active language centre in New South Wales at the moment, is a minor partner helping on the sidelines, and we've had assistance, largely financial, from the Foundation for Endangered Languages, and if anyone's here, thank you. And the kind of partnerships we've got, obviously a master-apprentice, there's us two here as teacher and student, and we've also the university, the school Brad works at, and the Jabulum community and the Many Rivers Aboriginal Language Centre. There's a range of different levels of partnership operating here. So what did we set out to do? We wanted to give a local Australian and New South Wales a demonstration of master-apprentice, a kind of proof of concept in the local field. Not that we have any doubt that the method works, but we wanted to demonstrate it to people so that they could see what it is actually supposed to look like, rather than being some of the things that were cited before. We wanted to evidence to communities in New South Wales and locally to the Bunjalung communities that adult intergenerational transmission is possible. It's not something that people can't make happen, which is, I think, the concern a lot of people have, that, you know, it's just too hard. We'll teach the kids, but for me as an adult to try and learn my own language is too hard. We wanted to foster acquisition for Brad as a prospective teacher of his language and obviously with some depth of oral proficiency. To get people to use more spoken wailable in their community by having it actively spoken again, by having it heard by people, and to foster awareness of its existence as a minority, one of the dialects of the language, and that there was a need and potential for it to be revitalised, so bring it up its profile. And through the process of Brad learning Wailable as an apprentice to record everything and foster through that process increased documentation of the dialect, and particularly to inform policy development in the light of those kind of observations that we started out with about, you know, we got to do master apprentice here. Well, let's have a look and, you know, is it going to work or not? Some of the logistics we're faced with, the distance between 70 and 80 kilometres, 50 miles, guys. for those of you who are not metricated. So the separation there, and I'm also separated from Brad in his normal location and the master apprentice by about 700 kilometres. So that, fortunately, I think keeps me at arm's length and allows them to operate without the linguist being in the middle of everything. Very limited to capacity, but there's no phones, Brad?
No, no phones.
Poppy Harry can't, we can't do phones. We have to kind of hope somebody else in the community might answer one and run a message.
Fingers crossed.
Harry has very poor health.
Yes.
Brad is employed full-time as a teacher, and we have funding for 36 hours, which is far less than is the optimum to, but we've figured, well, that'll give us a proof of concept at least. It'll let us get some of the way. No paid release for apprentice, not quite so true now because Brad has managed to get from the Department of Education some release time, which has been great for them to do. The 36 versus 300 hours is a variation from the ideal model. The training also, we didn't engage in a great deal of practical training because Brad is already a qualified languages teacher and a graduate student in Indigenous languages education under my eminent tutelage. And I assessed, based on our joint reading of Hinton, that he is more than equipped to evaluate the applicability and make very informed decisions about how to use it. Is that right, Brad?
Yes.
Okay. The training from the master, Poppy Harry has been identified by linguists as a natural immersion teacher, so that was a great bonus for us. He's been supplied with a copy of Hinton. I don't know that he's necessarily read it, but he has it, and Brad is free to discuss it with him. And I might turn over to Brad now to talk about what's actually been happening on the ground.
Okay, the fun part. Before we start, I just wanted to say a few things about the way in which indigeneity is sorted out in Australia. Someone mentioned it in another conference today, and I just wanted to raise the issue of identification. My grandmother was Aboriginal from a place called Bungawalpin Creek, and I've never actually explained this before to a group of people like you, so I thought I'd do it today. Because of my grandmother, it's extremely important, and it's in part of me that's not just spiritual, it's inside me. So it's something that I won't ever let go of, and I don't care what people say about whether you need to look Aboriginal or what, however. It's inside me, and it's something that's really important, and it's something I'll continue to teach for my kids. But what we did is we had 3 hours of recording so far that we've done. We didn't do a lot yet because it's quite difficult. As you can see, we had 3 failed attempts. And on those 3 failed attempts, one time is I rang Poppy. He said, yeah, I'll be there, and I drove down. And then an hour later when I arrived, he'd gone to the dentist. Another time he went walkabout, which is just down the creek, and, you know, did his own thing. So it's a really, really different cultural experience when you get involved and you see a different side of it. Of the 3 hours we did, it was the best experience that I ever had. One of the activities we did was we did some cooking. Another one we did was we did some gardening. And the final one that we did was my favourite, and that was look at photo albums of family. So it was a really fun way to engage in the language. It was hard because of all the interruptions we had, but I'm just such a fan of this way of learning. Having learned other languages myself, I hated learning from books. So learning Japanese in Japan, learning Spanish in South America, really preempted me to get into what I should have been doing right from the start anyway. I just didn't have the confidence then to try and do it with my own situation and also my own language. So even though we haven't come very far, I think we've come a long way in understanding the process that's required and the commitment that's required for this, which is unbelievable. You just have to be so focused, and every time something goes wrong, you have to be willing to fight and keep going until something happens that's productive.
Yeah. Just to say, the ASLPR is the Australian Second Language Proficiency Ratings, which is the model that we used to determine that Brad actually didn't speak Bundjalung when we started. Oops, wrong mouse button.
Okay. So, from my observations, there's no reason to question the method, but it's just, as I said before, it's not as simple as it seems. When I first started with John, I said to John, yeah, I can do this. It's going to be easy. It's going to be fun. Having taught languages and loving immersion, I knew I could do it. But you're so reliant on, and that's what I love about this approach, you're so reliant on your elder to really sort of guide you through, and you're like the puppet, you're like the baby in the scenario, and you really have to trust so much is what they're doing. But in that trust is also the risk of, you know, it not working on a day, and you might be giving up your whole day, and that's when it can fall apart. But that's only transient, and you just keep pushing through until things start kicking in. And I'm hoping that things start kicking in so much that you really notice it, and it'll really manifest that from that point on. But at the moment, I'm still at the stage of thinking, where am I going with this? Is it going to work? You know what I mean? But I'm hoping that that progresses from there. One thing, these are the observations I noticed that were the most predominant. One of them was the importance and influence of location. When Poppy Harry is with me and he is talking about his environment, it usually the terms that come up are specific to where we grew up, which was Jabalum, which is a mission. So if we have the Blue Mountains or the Waila, which are the black cockatoos, he knows everything that he sees. But if I wanted to talk to him about Sydney, he would really struggle with the vocabulary and the lexical structures in place that we require to do that. Other things like cultural transmission. One thing we did notice from my observations is that the culture, and specifically the local culture, were really important because that was what was coming out of the sessions. And also primarily the lack of use that Poppy Harry has. He's a native speaker, but what I've noticed is over the time, because he has no one to speak to, he is the last surviving native speaker of Wallabal ever at this stage in the game. He constantly is trying to reflect on what he's saying, because just to keep the language alive, he'll go down to the river and talk to himself because he has no one to talk to. And we've noticed he's lost quite a lot of his language because of that. But interestingly, on the flip side, the more I do, the more that seems to refire back up in his brain, and he can really pull it out, which is really fun. Also, this is probably the most exciting point here, the generating the local community. A lot of kids come up and they interact with us when we're engaging in our experiences and learning, and they interrupt, which is extremely frustrating. But at the same time, it's beautiful because they want to know, why are you here? What's going on? And that is sparking the whole mission. Not just the mission of what we're doing, but the mission, which is what we call Jabalum. Kids want to get into it. We're looking at immersions for young ones now, one day, because the interest is generated there. And that's what leads us to the last point. When it works, when everything's relaxed and natural, it's so fun. And that's why I love this approach. The future. As John said, there are times when you just think you want to give up and you feel like time's running out. But any documentation strategy should be pursued. The MA is worth pursuing to both preserve high individual proficiency in documentation, and funding for the Master Apprentice looks likely to be problematic at different stages. So John really fought to get this program up and running. It was really hard to get funding. But I guess the impetus for us is to always remind ourselves we must just keep pushing through all those boundaries, because as you guys know who, you know, are leading the way with this project, it's up to us as the academics and the teachers and the Indigenous elders to keep it running so that the next generation have a voice in language development and also have speakership and fluency and access. In terms of class-based instruction, we have to sort of think about is the master apprentice approach leading in to the classroom? Because obviously that's my other job and that's where I'm passionate. That's what I'm passionate about. So we need to think about, is that the most cost-effective way as well of developing speakership among our students and learners and generally people who want to learn the language. So that's it. Yeah, so far.
Questions?
Could I just one last thing? I think one thing that that I'd say is we're probably faced, given the time constraints, the loss of access to speakers, and the need for some kind of planning. We lack planning very much in our context. There's got to be some pragmatic decision about whether pursuing something at Master Apprentice to give us a limited number of speakers but retain a depth of fluency is the goal that people want versus that. Given the silly existence of the syllabus, a breadth of speaker population, but who are just not going to have anywhere near the depth of fluency. And I don't particularly have a favourite answer, but I think we just want to draw out that in our context, people are at a crossroads where they're going to have to make maybe a decision or work out how they're going to allocate resources to those two things. And also, I'd like to thank Leanne for allowing me to visit with her a couple of years ago and talk. It might have seemed like a fairly lightweight conversation, but it grew into something else.
Are you videotaping? Is that how you're...
No, that's a good question. Didn't raise that. We just have like a little microphone and we just sit it down wherever we're doing an activity and we just forget about it. Because we found that technology can really impede the natural situation and we didn't want that. And also Poppy was very anti-technology. So the less we showed it to be a formalised approach to learning, the better for him. And also the better for me. Even as a teacher, I wanted to do this stuff. I didn't want to, you know, feel like I was being tested or...
Be your own cameraman.
Yeah.
We were to some extent warned off by a field linguist.
To do it, but on the other hand, just thinking from the point of view of documentation, what you might have then on your tape is informal language about objects that you're looking at and handling that where it's sort of hard to understand. It could be hard to understand what's going on when there's no visual about the object. And are you working in, and then there's the issue of translation, which is against master apprentice principles, but important for documentation principles when this is the last speaker.
Well, I could answer that. Use other funding sources to do projects like that. So as we do the Master Apprentice, there are things happening right now where there are grants in place where Poppy goes and gets videoed specifically on activities in language. And everything that is done through different funding sources in Australia or in DET and in New South Wales is accessed through all different departments. So if the Board of Studies or if DET or if the Koori Centre in the University is doing something, usually you have access to that. But in terms of videoing here, I think you have to do what's comfortable for your elder. And certainly for me, I wouldn't do it simply because I know that he'd be uncomfortable with that situation and I don't want that. Maybe later when he's more comfortable and we both speak better together, maybe he could do it then, but there's no way that he'd be comfortable with that now.
Just a question about the language situation. Are there any people around who understand but don't speak the language? Because usually near the end of a language, there's sort of people of
that's a good question.
Very,
very few. And if they did, they wouldn't admit it. So you'd have to really try and... You have to find different tactics to find that kind of information out. But I'm almost certain that, you know, you're looking at a handful of people in Wallabal. Because it's so specific to Jabalum area, most people are reluctant to even put their hand up and say they understand a little bit of it. And the reason is simply the shame issues associated with the past. But because of programs like this, that's now changing. And because I'm going into Jabalum, and that's never happened before, and that was actually verbalised recently, one lady said to me, you know, no one's ever come in and actually sat down and wanted to learn from me before, you know, because I knew that she knew a little bit. And just those little things really quickly changed the attitudes of people who didn't know the language, didn't want to know it previously, and now they want to know it. And I'll never forget one elder said to me, wow, you know more than me. And she was embarrassed, and so she worked really hard to know more than me the next time I came down. So that was really exciting.
Margaret Henry. Don't quote me back, I'd be embarrassed by what I said now. No, it's okay.
I've got about 10 replies, all sort of, which probably come into those categories that you had listed at the beginning, and so none of them were real examples of the Master Apprentice program. And do you, having done this, do you have a sense of why that is? Why there hasn't been any take-up, any real take-up before?
I think they've seen the cover of the book, and they've intuitively decided what is inside it. I think there's actually very few people who have done any detailed reading of Leanne's materials, and there's a lot of just been a presumption about what Master Apprentice is, what constitutes Master Apprentice, and that's revealed by what people are identifying as. Clearly, you know, it has maybe some vague connection, but very limited. So I don't think a lot of people have actually taken the time to find out.
It's why they used in Alaska, it's why they used in Minor in Alaska. People who are apprentices read it. We have an 84-year-old mentor reading the whole thing, doing everything. If you do everything in the book, I'd like to thank you for all the encouragements.
That was actually a colleague of ours, yeah. Susan Perch, who'll be discussing the Board of Studies Aboriginal Languages Generic Syllabus tomorrow afternoon, last session. With the curtains open.
Yeah, that's a good idea. They're 4 and 3, but I'll try. Might be like this, but yeah.
What's the wallable word for rugrat?
Jar jar.
Not at this stage. That's the maintenance of Indigenous
languages
and records program under the Commonwealth Government in Australia, for those who don't know.
Just say it's underwater arts and the environment, the best,
Well, just I guess to finish,
we haven't approached them. I think it was probably just a matter of the FEL call for grants came around. I went, I wonder.
Yeah.
And we were shocked to find out we were the largest successful single grant that they gave out last year.
And I guess just to finish as a more comical note, just on funding, I actually wrote to the Prime Minister this year. And that's because he speaks fluent Chinese, and I thought, oh, I'll just try. And I wrote to him and said, look, is there any way I could have a year off? Because I really need to learn this language, and you know, my elder's sick, and I just really need to do it. So that's how passionate I am about it. And John's great as a support and a mentor. But at the end of the day, we all just want to speak our languages. And this is a fantastic way for us to access that for our kids and for the future of our languages. So thank you again, Leanne, for starting that up. It was great.
Thank you.
Not yet.
He's only the Prime Minister, man. He's not the head of the Department of Education.
Can you?
Have you got a plug
it's
in?
On, no, it's already on there.
Oh, lucky
so
you.
Just need
yeah,
to
press.
No,
no,
no, no,
there's
something.
Are you going to be in PowerPoint?
Our master appraisal program for our tribe in Wisconsin. Yeah, so
I have a CD.
Stop doing
recording.
I don't want you to walk.